Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. In the next hour, we're talking about climate change. A report released this month by UN scientists says carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut almost in half from 2010 levels in the next 12 years to limit the worst effects of climate change and environmental damage. If not, they say the damage could reach more than $50 trillion. Local governments in Wisconsin are already trying to adapt to the effects of climate change. In this hour, we're talking with Andrea Krause, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. What do you take away from that report and some of the findings in it at the local level? Andrea, you want to share some thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, in the Public Works Department, one of the major components of our job is managing city infrastructure, and a big part of that is water infrastructure. We handle wastewater and stormwater. And so while temperature increases are not a big part of our mission or addressing temperature changes in water or in the air, what we do see is the increased intensity of storm events. We also see, related to temperature, rain in the winter. We've gone almost 3 years where there has been rain in every single month for a three-year period. And that's a new thing for us to be dealing with. When we have rain in the middle of the winter, we have more damage to roads and pipes, more freezing and seeping. And so winter rains end up being a whole different problem as far as transport of other pollutants like salt into rivers and lakes as well, too. So, I guess the temperature does affect the Public Works Department in the context of we're getting rain events in the middle of January, February, and that's a new thing.
Yeah, it's no surprise, I think, to scientists that as temperatures rise, that you see more evaporation and moisture in the atmosphere, and then, like you said, more frequent, intense, heavy rainfalls. And so, I guess, what about you, Deanna? I mean, in the work that you do, How do you bring something like that down to a local level?
Yeah, well, the IPCC report really is a call to action for governments around the world, and that ultimately has to come down to a smaller scale. Although what we can do internationally to address climate change and what we can do nationally are both really important. At the end of the day, the transition away from fossil fuels, which is necessary because fossil fuels produce carbon. Carbon creates a heat-trapping blanket in the atmosphere of the Earth, and that's why we're in this situation to begin with. So that ultimately has to happen within municipalities, within counties, through our local power cooperatives or energy companies. And so, you know, here on Lake Superior, we have some really specific impacts. We have some really specific changes that we're dealing with. But we also sit in, you know, within cities and within governments, within the context of government, that we do need to talk with about these changes that we need to see. You know, there's really large-scale opportunities globally to shift towards a successful future for the Earth, for ourselves. But there's local opportunities as well. And a lot of times for many of us, that's the scale we live at. And so, you know, what the IPCC report means to me is we need to deal with stormwater. We're getting more rain. How do we approach that? We need to transition energy, and we've seen some real leadership in our area to transition to renewable energy sources. And we also need to perhaps transition in some ways our way of life. You know, we identify as being cold weather people, very tough northern people. But the climate we live in is transitioning away from that in some ways. And so, you know, what we do for fun, when we tap trees for maple syrup, the fish that we want to pursue, you know, there's some management changes for people who deal with the landscape that we need to consider. And there's also, you know, personal things in our daily lives where you might really like to fish walleye and then you're going to start fishing for bass, you know? So there's many scales of transition that we're in the midst of all at once.
Right. It affects so many different layers of things, mm-hmm. you know, as you pointed out. I guess, Andrea, in the work that you do at Public Works and the Environmental Services Division, what are you seeing as some of the impacts that you're already dealing with? You mentioned, like, that was one thing I didn't think of as far as rainfall in the wintertime. I don't think a lot of people think of that, but the freezing of pipes and other things. How have you seen that impact the way that things operate?
Well, we have to look at new construction that's happening in the community and what our permitting requirements are a little more with that eye to what can we expect the weather to be like. For example, anytime there's a large construction project within the city, there needs to be a stormwater permit, and that manages how the construction is done so that erosion doesn't come off of the site. But then that completed project also has to attenuate or keep on that property a 1 to 2 year storm event, all the rain that would fall. So it should leave the community in better shape after it's been developed. So instead of what would come off of an undeveloped vegetated lot, we're now keeping more of that rain on site and allowing it to soak into the ground. So what we have on the books now for requirements might need to be updated based on projections for increased intense storms. How we build our communities is likely going to have to change. What we see is curbs and gutters as a clean look for an urban environment. We might need to change how we perceive that. For example, we could look at more green street options, green infrastructure to return our development to something more in line with the natural water cycle, which has a cleaning property for water. If that water can soak into the ground before it reaches a stream, it's getting filtered, it's getting cooled, it's preserving base flow conditions. So in the summer, the streams have water in them, but it also means that it's holding back those really high peak flows during a rain event so that we have less erosion, we have less runoff, and pollution being transported into local Superior streams and into Lake Superior. One of the things the city is embarking on right now is a green infrastructure code audit. And that's getting just at this very issue of how do we build our communities to be more resilient in the face of changing climates and increasing intense storms. Some codes are outdated. They don't allow for some of the new technologies out there. Gray water systems or capturing water and using it on a property for irrigation, other types of things like that.
Yeah, I think of that in terms of how, you know, communities have beautification ordinances maybe where they require property owners to mow their lawn or something. You might want to have your lawn grow up real tall, like, you know, which goes against what people have thought in the past, but it would hold more water maybe. And prevent some of that runoff.
That's exactly it. Yeah, it is looking at even what's allowed on city property. There are ordinances around, like you mentioned, how tall grass can be. But if somebody wants to have a native plant landscape in their front yard, they might be limited by local codes and ordinances. So some of that's education, so people know what they're looking at, and they see the value in having tall plants that are flowering at different times of the year and providing habitat, but also allowing water to soak in. But a lot of it can't be seen. A lot of the infrastructure that is needed to be updated is underground. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, unless there's a problem. And so part of it is helping people understand how our communities are being built currently, and understanding the ways that we can improve on that, not just by upsizing pipes, which is one thing that needs to be considered at times to accommodate bigger rainfall events and prevent flooding, but looking at where that water goes. So right now we have a constructed wetland basin in North Superior on Poplar Avenue. And it takes all the water coming off of Belknap Street. Once this project on Belknap is completed, all the stormwater will go to this basin instead of going directly to a stream. And in that basin, it slows down. There's a meander in the design of that basin. And so sediment will drop out because the water's slowing down in its flow towards Lake Superior. And there are plants that are there to help absorb and take up not only the nutrients in the water, but any pollutants as well. So the water's getting cleaned, again, kind of using what we know from the water cycle and what happens in a natural environment to manage water and protect streams and lakes.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of the work that's being done has kind of come about because of all the flooding that we've seen in recent years. I think it's been three federal disaster declarations in the last 6 years for northern Wisconsin. And I know you guys are all familiar with the pictures of Lake Superior and all the sediment that was rushing into the lake and how it looks like chocolate milk. But what are some of the impacts that we're seeing right now, Deanna, you know, related to all of this change in the weather patterns? And, you know, how is this affecting the coastal communities along Lake Superior?
Yeah, I'll start with the lake. So when we have big storms, we can see it. We're getting a lot of very sort of muddy-looking water coming out of our rivers. And to some degree, that's natural. Superior is built on clay, on what used to be the bottom of the lake. And so, you know, you think of the muck at the bottom of the lake if you go swimming and your feet go down into it and it feels kind of gross. That's what we have for soil underneath us here is we have this clay, red clay. And so that erodes really easily. But in these big storms, you know, the soil gets saturated and then there's really no way for the water to no place for the water to go. And so it gets carried over land or carried off the bottom of the river and heads out into the lake. The Nemadji River is notorious, but almost all the rivers along the South Shore, you know, between here and like Bad River, kind of that area, really do kind of have that characteristic. And so that's a lot of stuff going out into the lake, and that stuff contains nutrients. It's very high turbidity, we say, so it's really cloudy, and it has a darker color than the water in the deep, clearer parts of the lake. And that darker color, just like when you're wearing a black t-shirt, it makes the water warmer because it absorbs more energy from the sun. So warmer water has less oxygen in it, and the sediment coming out of the rivers carries a lot of nutrients, and nutrients fuels the bottom of the food web in Lake Superior. So we think of Lake Superior as being very clear and cold. Lakes like that we call oligotrophic. There's just not a lot of stuff in them, not a lot of living things in them, but they're really clear, clean water. In the coast right now, along the nearshore area of the lake, in this part of the lake where we've got these big sediment plumes, we're starting just now, since 2012, to see algae blooms. Lake Erie notoriously has really significant problems with algae blooms, but here, I think we didn't think about it really all that much because the lake that we're used to is so clear and we haven't seen those in the past.
And cold.
Yeah, and cold. And so now we've got different conditions than what we used to have. And that has an impact potentially on human health. It has a potential impact on our drinking water because some algae, some cyanobacteria actually, can make a toxin that hurts your liver or hurts your brain. And so we haven't seen... We're not sure if we're seeing those toxins yet. We did a bunch of data collection. The scientific community did a bunch of collection this summer to try to figure out what exactly we're looking at. But that's a big change. And in communities, you know, particularly right now where we've had an unprecedented number of years of high water level in a row. So as far as the record that we have goes back into the 1800s, that record of water levels, we've never seen this many years of high water in a row. That's really impacting. It's impacting roads. You know, we love to drive along roads or walk along the lake, drive along the lake, walk along the lake. It's pretty. It's really calming. It's a great place to go see sunsets. But a lot of those spots are getting washed out by storm surges that are related to big storms. It's just water getting pushed up over the road. And it's almost strange because, in a way, right now we're dealing with similar impacts to sea level rise, even though it has different mechanisms. So those are expensive to fix. And, you know, we might have to start thinking about, like, okay, we got to move this road. We got to move this trail. And we don't want to because it's so pretty there.
Yeah, it was especially with all the lake walk damage we've seen here in Duluth. And I know in Herbster, they've been mm-hmm. repairing a road there along the lakeshore. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
It is still, you know, I mean, and the impacts are different, you know, as the cycle goes up and down, you know. I mean, it was it 2010? We had record low lake
yep.
levels, and now it's back up high again. You know, as we're seeing all these different changes, what kind of resources are available to adapt to that? Or what discussions are being had to adapt to the changing conditions?
Well, I'm going to go back to this code audit that the city's just embarking on now, and that's in partnership with Wisconsin Sea Grant. And so this is a way for, there's a manual that's been created by Wisconsin Sea Grant for communities to go through existing codes and ordinances and figure out where there are hindrances to implementing green infrastructure and new technologies to make communities more resilient to changes in rainfall and other climate and weather impacts. So some of these extension services like Minnesota and Wisconsin Sea Grant are really good places to go for both municipalities, but also residents. There are things that can be done on your own home. When we talk about stormwater pollution, we talk about how this is a non-point source. It's a lot of diffuse sources of pollution that end up having a huge cumulative effect, and it can be really negative. It's one of the biggest sources of pollution to water nationwide, is just what's running off of our own properties. But we can have a cumulative positive effect, too, when people start identifying where they can make small changes in their behaviors. And that might be things like taking the bus, carpooling when possible, to minimize the amount of energy and fossil fuels they're using in transportation in their own homes. It could be installing or putting in native plants. Rain gardens, something more engineered like that is an option, but even planting native plants have much deeper root systems, which means the water is able to infiltrate deeper into the soil more quickly than with turf grass, for example. So there are little things that people can do that will absolutely add up when we're all working towards that same goal. So even though it might not look like it's making a big difference in one place, I think we know that we have the potential to make some big changes as people shift their attitudes and behaviors.
Well, just in the last decade, we've seen the amount of coal that's come through the Twin Ports go down significantly mm-hmm. as utilities are shifting away from coal-fired power plants to more renewable sources of energy. And as we're sitting here this week, there's a discussion about the proposed $700 million energy center that would work on natural gas and renewable energy in Superior. You know, utility providers are working with communities, and communities are exploring solar panels and different methods, especially we've seen a lot of those projects here in northern Wisconsin on the South Shore, where they had the largest group buy this year of solar power, I believe. But, you know, this all seems to also come at a time that's very challenging, though, because things have changed at the state and federal level. I mean, it seems like every budget cycle it comes up where you mentioned, Andrea, Minnesota and Wisconsin Sea Grant, and also the National Estuarine Research Reserve would come under this, too, where there's been proposed cuts to these mm-hmm. programs and funding for them that hasn't gone through as of yet. But, you know, as the threat of funding or reduced funding levels is there, how are agencies working to address that in a different way, I guess, you know, or you simply just not able to do as much?
One of the things that's really surprised me is the level of bipartisan congressional support for things like Sea Grant and for the National Estuarine Research Reserve System. Though the administrative support hasn't really been there, ultimately Congress does decide a budget, and that goes through the OMB. And so we have actually received increases, and the reason for that is because we are becoming increasingly necessary. People who study, understand, and can provide help to communities to adapt to climate change, that's a really valuable service. And so I think the communities that that those agencies work in can see the value and communicate that value to their representatives. And so it is strikingly bipartisan, particularly for the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. And I think everyone who is doing this work, although at the state level, there's been a few more challenges with staffing, you know, overall. But everyone who is working on it, there's a great deal of effort. And that's what I was going to mention for your question before. Not necessarily who's providing the opportunities for individual action, but I think it's important for your listeners to know that the National Park Service is doing research on the impacts of climate change in our region through the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. In Minnesota and Duluth, Large Lakes Observatory is doing incredible work on the physics of climate change, particularly on large lakes, not just here, but all over the planet. Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab has been working for a very long time to understand how climate impacts our communities, and that effort continues. And they are using more of a economic framework, more and more through NOAA, to really make sense of you know, the cost of not adapting. And then, you know, with the reserve, even here in Superior, we have what's called a Sentinel site, where we're looking at how vegetation and sedimentation, so muck that washes down in storms, how those are being impacted by increasing rain events. And I also wanted to mention, too, that it's not just rain, it's also ice. And so Lake Superior, and we're not totally sure what that's going to mean for our lives. You know, in some ways, there's benefits. Like, if we don't have to go cut 8 feet of ice for ships to get through the lake, like, people will be happy about that generally. But we do, we don't totally understand. We're looking potentially within 30 years of not having, you know, modeled impacts on Lake Superior, not having ice on the lake, really to any significant degree. And so what that means for our winter climate, we're still trying to figure out. A lot of that effort is coming through Large Lakes Observatory. And so there are civic actions, there's individual actions, but there's also knowledge and studying the system where we live. You know, we have very large scale global overviews like the IPCC report, but we have some very dedicated people in our community who are studying what's happening to us right here along Lake Superior. And that is to our advantage. And hopefully having that information translated to the civic realm will really help us know what to do next.
Again, we're talking about climate change with Andrea Krause, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. In the next hour, we're talking about climate change. A report released this month by UN scientists says carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut almost in half from 2010 levels in the next 12 years to limit the worst effects of climate change and environmental damage. If not, they say the damage could reach more than $50 trillion. Local governments in Wisconsin are already trying to adapt to the effects of climate change. In this hour, we're talking with Andrea Krause, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. Well, what do you think that communities are most wanting then? You know, as they come to you trying to find some of the best research or answers related to adapting to climate change, what is it that they want to know or need to know? Mm-hmm. You know, Deanna or Andrea?
Well, I think about, kind of two ends of that, and there's probably more. but people often want the low-hanging fruit. What's the biggest bang for the buck? So where, and that can mean a couple different things. So where's there going to be an easy fix where we can build on successes? So you can say we did this thing and it made things better in this way. It's quantitative. We can look at before and after data and say this has helped. It's improved water quality, or it's improved access to water for people, whatever it might be. But there's also a huge value in preserving what's already in good shape. And we know it costs much more to restore something that's degraded than to preserve something that's already in good shape. So I think another way we have to look at this is figuring out where are the areas that we need to protect right now, and what can we do to ensure that they stay as healthy and pristine as they are currently, so that we don't have to come in with restoration dollars in another 10, 20, 30 years, and at oftentimes taxpayer costs. I think about the relationship between headwater communities and downstream communities, and just the concept of sediment transport. You mentioned the Nemadji River, and it's a river that tends to run fairly turbid or muddy naturally, but there's been increases in the amount of mud that's moving through that river, and there's also a loss of wetlands in the headwater, areas that naturally hold back these big rain events, so there's more erosion that's happening in channel. But there's a cost to taxpayers downstream in dredging the harbor. And so there's ways that we could be looking at the costs of this degradation that we might not be fully factoring in right now. That might help people see how they're connected to decisions in development, 100 miles away from where they're living. But they're connected through these watersheds and stream channels.
Yeah, because this report by UN scientists talked about if we don't do something by 2030 to reduce emissions, that we're going to see worse effects of climate change, and that's going to be costly. Mm-hmm. I just feel like people are kind of overwhelmed about how to take steps to, reduce the impacts of climate change. And then there are people who say that this is just cyclical. This is what we deal with all the time. And there's nothing new or different about this.
There definitely are people who say that, but generally speaking, they're not scientists. there is scientific consensus on climate change and climate change being caused by human activity. And, you know, there is, in science, there's always elements of uncertainty. But we all deal with uncertainty in our lives, you know, who we decide to marry, where we decide to live, what job we decide to take. There's always, unless you have really something good, but always a little bit of uncertainty when we make big decisions. And the same thing is true about climate. We have a lot of very good information globally in the United States through our federal agencies, through NASA, through NOAA, and at the state level. And we know a lot about what's happening. There's certainly disagreements on how to go about solving those problems as well. But there is a tremendous social advantage in a lot of ways in moving forward with taking action. One thing I wanted to give just a really tangible example of impacts that can be expensive, because I agree with Andrea, you know, how we still have limited budgets and infrastructure is expensive, and what do we do? So over in Ashland, the Superior Rivers Watershed Association, which I work with through my education program, they have, you know, when a culvert blows out, so the pipe that carries a stream under a road, when a culvert blows out in a big storm, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, they're only will pay for the same size culvert. And in some cases, it's pretty frustrating for local municipalities, because they're like, well, that culvert just blew out. Like, we don't want to put that same size back in there. And so what Superior Rivers is doing is writing grants to match the FEMA dollars that are coming in so that the municipality can pay for a larger culvert, or in some cases, even a bridge. And that is helping to keep huge amounts of sediment out of the lake in big storms, protecting trout streams, because trout don't like a lot of sediment on the bottom of a lake, and they like their water cold, and also helping to save municipalities, particularly rural municipalities, a lot of money. So there's some really tangible things that are just kind of win-win.
Yeah, if you think about the costs that are already happening, just looking at the federal disaster declarations and the amount of money that it's taken to try and repair the damages to the area. I think the 2016 flood in northern Wisconsin was around $30 to $35 million worth of damage, and this time around it was less. But I also think that about a third of Wisconsin was declared a federal disaster area this year because of flooding, and I can't remember the last time that happened. So we're seeing the costs right now, and as you pointed out, there's work that's being done to address that. What kind of policies or action do we need to encourage things that might save us money in the long term?
One thing that comes to mind right away, you know, just to build on what Andrea was saying, is retaining the function of wetlands. So wetlands absorb a lot of water. They're really good at it. It's what they do. They're professional. And when we have those in our watersheds, they are able to absorb a lot of the impacts of floods. And so there are policies associated with how we manage wetlands in the face of development. And retaining the function of wetlands is something that's both ecological and political in nature that I think has a pretty well-understood track record in being able to help communities.
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, a lot of that is what constituents are telling their representatives they care about. So making sure people are engaged in that process, of course, voting for people that will speak to those values of preservation of what we have in this area. Some of it is also going to be understanding that we might be, in some cases, passing the baton. We might be carrying some of this work forward for a period of time and not always seeing the it come to fruition with the final project or outcome, but that might be something that goes into the future. So we might just need to keep moving that progress forward, even if the outcome isn't a short-term gain. So I think that's one of the big challenges, is we're just not hardwired to think about things long-term. We think about the immediate consequences of our actions and what we need right now. And so being able to think about long-term implications of what we're doing is just a really challenging thing. When we're able to see that through a report like this that's making predictions and modeling, that's helpful, but a lot of there is still some unfortunate distrust of science, maybe because of the very nature of how it's done and the fact that people do say this is the degree of certainty that we believe we have. People hear the hesitation perhaps in that report versus hearing the certainty of it. You know, when 99% of the scientists say this is what's happening and we expect that climate is going to keep warming and that we'll see bigger storms.
You know, I'm just curious about your point of view, because, you know, one of the things that we hear sometimes when reports like this come out is that it hasn't been peer reviewed, or that there's more research that needs to be done. Do you feel like some of those statements are a way of delaying action?
There's always more research that can be done. I mean, a good scientist is going to know what the limitations of their work has been and what they would want to do next to address that. It's like if you are a critical thinker, it's hard to ever, you know, you're not going to find perfection in anything. And many scientists do that with their own work. So, sure, there are going to be limitations. There are limitations in the projects I do in my own house, even though I really do them to the best of my abilities. But would I go back and do them differently? Sure, because I learned in the process of doing this work. So the public perception of how science is done and that there's room for interpretation is somewhat problematic. I know that's something that Deanna tries to work on a lot, is helping people understand not only how to ask a question and get a result, collect the right data, set up a study so that you're looking at the right question and then analyzing your results, but then how to communicate that in a meaningful way. So how do we put that into action? And, you know, so this, if there's concern about this not being peer-reviewed, well, the number of scientists that are involved in this particular report is significant.
Science is brutal. It's brutal. You go through, you know, a year or 2 years of collecting data. You have huge spreadsheets. You put it through statistical software. You have to find the right formula to make your statistics run correctly without error. You have to correct all the errors or things don't work. And then you have to write it all up in some very specific language to your field. And then you put it out there for peer review. And peer review is the best people in your field trying to poke holes in your argument. And it's hard. And so peer-reviewed science underpins a lot of public-facing reports like the IPCC report. You know, the data that they're drawing on comes through the peer review process. When researchers put their paper, you know, their findings up for peer review, most times it's going to come back to them with like a C grade and all the things you need to correct. And these are, you know, PhD type folks. So, you know, a report itself, a public facing report, isn't necessarily going to be subject to the same kind of peer review, but the science it's based on is. What we're trying to do with reports like that is communicate in a way that people can understand. So, for example, we have X number of years to really get things transitioned to a non-carbon dependent economy or energy system. So that's something that gives policymakers or gives citizens an idea of what the best of what scientists can understand that we have to work with. And that communication is really necessary. It's hard for scientists to do it because there is always an element of uncertainty. There's always an element of critique. Nonetheless, it is, people should always read critically, but it is worth considering the weight and of the recommendations.
Again, we're talking about climate change with Andrea Kraus, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. In the next hour, we're talking about climate change. A report released this month by UN scientists says carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut almost in half from 2010 levels in the next 12 years to limit the worst effects of climate change and environmental damage. If not, they say the damage could reach more than $50 trillion. Local governments in Wisconsin are already trying to adapt to the effects of climate change. In this hour, we're talking with Andrea Kraus, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with the Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve.
You know, and I think about some of the reports that are coming out now and actions that have been taken in the past to deal with pollution or to deal with, you know, trying to improve water quality. We passed the Clean Air Act and we passed the Clean Water Act. And I think good or bad, however you feel about it, that made a difference. So do we need more regulation? Do we need more funding? Or because there's a lot of people who are saying government has overreached, government is hurting through regulation.
I think we need a lot of different things. And it's hard in a problem that is happening on such a large scale. It's hard to say this is the one thing that will do it. This will fix it. You know, we have, you know, the U.S. isn't part of the Paris Agreement right now. But there are a lot of municipalities and states that are still working on those. There are states that are still studying the impact of climate change through their own regulatory agencies and adjusting their policies accordingly. Where we choose to do those, if it's at the federal level, you need federal scale support and federal scale political will. You know, if we continue to struggle with those, there are other places where policy change can happen. That being said, we are looking at a very large-scale problem. And so, you know, it is a tough task, and it's somewhat daunting, I think, to everyone who's involved with climate change adaptation or mitigation personally, but also just for folks to think about, to even think about the scale that we need to transition. But as you referenced, there are points in history where we have made very large, very difficult social and environmental transitions. It's certainly not easy, but it has been done. It takes a really long time. And we're looking at something where we have a smaller window. Nonetheless, I think that people, even just thinking about it personally, talking to people in their life, talking to the political decision makers in their community, I think that all just, I hate to be cliche, but individual action really does add up.
When I think about the impact of federal policy like a passing of the Clean Water Act. One of the things we do at our office is tours of the wastewater treatment plant. And as we go about the tour, I'll usually, you know, say the plant was built in 1956. And in 1976, we added in this step in the process because we had funds from the Clean Water Act. And I'll always point out when we're literally walking through the treatment process, this is where we used to stop. This is where the water would then go out to Lake Superior, and people are aghast at it. absolutely legal at that point for the water to go out at that state. Clean Water Act was passed, and not only did it require that we cleaned the water better before it went out into the lake, but it provided funds to do that and to improve our wastewater treatment plant. And that was the last time there was a big change in water quality regulations, was with the Clean Water Act in 76. And we're learning a lot about emerging pollutants of concern, especially in the Great Lakes area, microplastics, other things that are ending up in not only our drinking water, but coming off of our clothes and the washing. And there are researchers right here at UWS that are leading the way on some of that work. So I do think that there's a need for assessing, with the new information we have, what are the new concerns that we weren't even clued into before, because we've changed what the goal is. We're no longer just focused on getting solid waste out of the waste stream. Now we're wanting to have cleaner water than what we had before, so we can continue swimming, so the fish and bugs and all the other aquatic organisms can live. It's part of what we appreciate about living in this area too, is what that brings to our life.
So what are some, I know you said you've been working on like the stormwater ponds and you know, trying to build that green infrastructure into the community to try and reduce the amount of pollution we see that goes into the lake, or to better handle stormwater runoff. So what are some of the things that you're doing or that you would like to see happen here in Superior to be more resilient? Are there things that are happening or that could happen?
Well, I've been really happy about some of the direction that the city's gone lately with prioritizing the green space and looking at how we use public areas, parks, shorelines, to preserve what we do have and use those as, in some ways, natural floodplains. There's a park, like, for example, Central Park in Superior, will, in high flow conditions, it will flood. And it's designed to do that and hold water in that particular area. So when we look at other public spaces, part of what we need to do is make sure that they can help us in holding back water in a place where it's not affecting someone's home or road or transport. But it's also educating people on what that means, because every time that happens in Central Park, we get calls from people saying the park is flooded, something's wrong. And folks need to understand how these natural systems are going to ebb and flow. They're not going to be static. We're going to have high flows and low flows. That's factored into the design. As we look at new development, what will we be requiring of new construction projects so that they are creating a safer environment for everybody that's living here by retaining water on site when it rains? And that's what we currently are doing with our building codes. But can we do that in ways that are additionally aesthetically pleasing? Rain gardens, some of the things you might see around some of the new developments now are doing just that. And people are seeing the value in not only holding these big storm events back to prevent flooding and erosion and pollution transport into Lake Superior, but creating a space at the same time that might be beautiful and a place where people can go and walk and is beneficial for the wildlife, the insects, pollinators, and things like that. So there can be multiple benefits in how we address this.
Yeah, and I would just add, like, the city of Superior and Duluth both deserve some kudos, because the staff in both cities has really started to think proactively about how to address climate change and how to be resilient. You know, the 2012 flood taught us a lot, and we learned what we didn't want to happen. And, you know, with limited funds and limited staff, there's a great deal of effort to take care of the community that we have in the future.
Well, is there anything I'm missing that you both want to add?
Yeah, there's some really interesting resources available for people who want to learn more about this or just want to understand it better. In Wisconsin, it was finished, I believe, in 2009, but we had the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change, and it's a pretty large report That details exactly what changes we expect to see, very similar to the IPCC report, but from quite a few years ago at this point. But it's the most up-to-date thing we have that's very detailed about Wisconsin. And you can learn more about that at climatewisconsin.org. That's a really good kind of entry website to that has some really cool videos that helps illustrate what we specifically as Wisconsinites are looking at. In Minnesota, in the Minnesota DNR, there is Office for Climatology, and there's some really great researchers there, but they've also kind of taken on a role of educators as well. And they're, if you just search Minnesota Department of Climate or Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Climatology, you can find some really interesting work that's being done to understand the changes that are expected and the changes that are happening now. And a lot of times it's not what we think it's going to be. It's like, oh, we don't have birch trees in our forest anymore. We have fewer black spruce or more white-tailed deer, or, you know, the changes that we're seeing are worth kind of getting a handle on, I think, so people can understand that what we talk about globally has a little bit different meaning that I think makes more sense when we look at it at our own scale.
This is maybe a little off subject, but I think people need to travel too. I think they need to broaden perspectives. I think working at a local level is really important in our communities to get the change we want and to build the communities the way we want so they'll be more resilient. And we might not have a lot of federal leadership on that right now, but there's a lot of leadership at local levels that are doing just that, and we can also look globally.
Again, we've been talking about climate change with Andrea Kraus, a water resources specialist with the Environmental Services Division at Public Works in Superior, and Deanna Erickson, education coordinator with Lake Superior National Estuarine Research Reserve. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next week. Until then, have a great weekend.